Let me tell you a cool story that happened yesterday. One of our small groups was volunteering at the National Guard. Where we meet for a church is right next to the National Guard Reservation. So once a month, they have a family support group, which is family members whose loved ones are in Afghanistan or Iraq. So we volunteer. We provide child care for these kids because they're really dadless, most of them. Their dads are over in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there's five adults. We're going to go over to the National Guard place. Now, the National Guard Reservation in Concord is split by a road, and the road happens to be where our church is on. So four of us get there on time, and we show up and meet the woman who, from the National Guard's over these, I think we had nine kids in there. And so we're having a good time, and our friend Adam, who's going to show up, and Adam's just, he fixes machines, but he's an airhead. I love Adam, but he's just an airhead. So he calls about 15 minutes late, said, "I'm on my way, I'm running late, I'll be there." An hour later, no Adam. Adam calls. Adam says, "I've got seven kids here. I got one on my lap. I'm playing checkers with another. Where are you guys?" And I said, "Adam, we got nine kids here. Where are you? You're not here." And he said, "No, I've got seven kids here all by myself. Where are you?" So I go to the woman in charge and I say, "We got a problem here. We got a guy watching kids that aren't in this room, and she knows nothing about them." So she gets on my cell phone, talks to Adam, and says, "Adam, give me over to somebody in charge." Well, come to find out, there was another family group meeting going on. This should make you feel secure. The National Guard didn't know there were two meetings going on. And anyway, Adam showed up to the wrong meeting. The kids had no child care. They're just sitting in a room with the parents having this meeting. And he shows up and says, "I'm from the church here to provide child care." I said, "Great." And so there's Adam taking care of seven kids whose parents they had made no plans for this, and Adam shows up accidentally. And so the rest of us are over where we're supposed to be watching kids, and I just chuckle at that whole picture because Adam is having a time of his life. He said, "I'll do this every other weekend." Of course, they don't meet every other weekend. And Elizabeth, the woman in charge of the child care and all that for the National Guard, she's just blown out of her mind that we're in two places watching kids and she didn't even know about this other group. I share that as a little story about how I see God using us in ways of mercy quite often, just blundering accidents. They're not planned. They're just accidents. I'm going to pray, and then I'll tell you a little bit about myself, and then we'll talk. I'm not cool, Ed. I'm just a guy that talks from the Bible, and I'll tell you a little bit about how that's worked out in caring for poor people and things like that. And I'm going to start with the Bible and then end up with some practical stuff. Jesus, I don't have to ask you anything more than I've asked you already today. But as I think about it, Lord, a song comes to mind, "Let us be your hands, let us be your feet. Give us eyes to see like you have eyes to see." Bless my brothers in this room. I pray in some small measure I can encourage them to extend the mercy of Christ to the poor and needy around them. In Christ's name, amen. Let me introduce myself. My name is Dave Pinckney. I'm 45 years old. I've been in pastoral ministry 22 years. We started the River of Grace Church six and a half years ago. This is my family. I have five teenagers this year. That's my social security system. Absolutely. There ain't going to be nothing left in a couple of years. So that's it. One of those kids is going to pay for me. One of them's in college. The twin boys on the right just turned 18 on Saturday. Isaac, the studly kid with the backward cap, he's 15. And my daughter, in 9 months, went from being my little girl to being a woman. She's 13, and I'm going to get her a purity bag. Just going to put it around her and surround it. It's hard. Anyway, I want to start with Micah chapter 6, verse 8, a very common verse. And we're going to fly through a bunch of verses here. By the way, all the pictures up after my family are pictures taken Dominican Republic. There's a dentist in our church who has built a compound down in Dominican Republic and has set up a dental clinic, and he's got this crazy guy down there who's trained, who's not a professional dentist, but actually he's probably better than the dentist you go to. I say he's crazy because if he's in my church, he'd be under church discipline all the time. But when he's in the dental clinic, he's an angel. He steps out of it. He's a something else. But Micah 6:8, if you don't know this verse, where have you been? The question being raised is, what does God want when you approach him? In fact, it even says there, does he want you to offer his firstborn? And Micah 6:8 is the answer to that question. He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. Three things there, to do justice. I'm not going to talk much about that, but I am going to show you from what I think from Genesis 3 and 4, the difference between justice and mercy from the narrative God gives us. So to do justice, to love mercy or to love kindness, and to walk with humility before God. And I think if you look at each of those things, I'm just going to talk about mercy because that's what I was assigned to talk about, and I think that's what we need to focus on. Let's look at the narrative and how the Bible starts and look where mercy first shows up. Genesis chapter 3, you know this, you know the gig. God makes a perfect world, makes this perfect couple, gives them the perfect mission, tells Adam, fill the earth, subdue it, or subdue the earth, fill it, have dominion over it, puts them in a 100-acre woods, kind of like Winnie the Pooh, says, okay, this is my garden, this is how I do it, now I expect you and your generations to go out and replicate this, build civilizations, love your wife, all these things. And the one moral absolute is, I do not want you to know evil, so do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And of course, we can't even follow one simple rule in the garden. So God has to figure out, what am I going to do with man? Not that God didn't know this ahead of time, but he has to kick him out of the garden because the other tree is the tree of life and didn't want him to eat the tree of life, whether that's symbolic or real. That's great for the theologians to debate, but here's the first thing God did when Adam and Eve sinned. He started a clothing mission. He clothed the kids. They were naked. They had nothing. He killed an animal and clothed them. He didn't instruct them on a bunch of stuff. He met a basic need. I think God models for us this mercy, this loving kindness. Genesis 3, 21. That's what the verse says. God clothed the naked man and woman. Now, if you wanted to debate what's the difference between justice, then go to Genesis 4, where Cain kills Abel, and there you see justice enacted because Cain, the murderer, God, in his justice, showed mercy and did not execute Cain. In fact, later on when, you know, he establishes the nation and comes up with laws, capital punishment was part of the law. You take someone's life, you take, you know, the nation of Israel is to take your life. But here in Genesis chapter 4, you see, I think, a great picture of God in justice. He deals in a just way, but justice was bathed in compassion. But we're not going to talk about justice. That's for someone else. We're going to talk about mercy. So we get this picture of mercy. God looks at a need. He meets the need. He looks with compassion at Adam and Eve and meets a need. Well, that sort of sets the framework from my perspective. Let's fast forward and say, what does Jesus say about this whole thing with mercy? One of my favorite verses is in Luke chapter 12, verse 32 or 33. And if you want to look there, it becomes a familiar passage, but unfortunately we overlook this incredible teaching on the mercy of God. We have this instruction, Luke chapter 12, Jesus is saying, hey, I don't want you worrying about your clothing, what you're eating. And I don't know about you, but I have to live these verses every day because I'm worried about it. I got a kid in college. I got three cars. I got, you know, mortgage. I'm just strapped. And I can sit up and worry all night. It's better to pray. So that's what the passage is teaching. Verse 22 says, and Jesus says, therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious about your life. I feel like he's talking to me, Dave. Do not be anxious about your life. I'm going to take care of you. So then you get down to verse 31. So rather than being anxious about your life, then seek first the kingdom of God. Seek the kingdom. The kingdom means, what is it like when the king walks into a need? Well, we found out in Genesis chapter 3, if he finds a need, naked people, he clothes them. So then you look at the very next verse, and this to me is, do not fear, little flock, or fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure, his intention to give you the kingdom. I paint this picture for myself all the time and for our congregation. Do not fear, little flock. The Father has so much in store for you. It is His pleasure. It is His delight. It is God's great plan to give you everything. The new heaven, the new earth, you read about it in Revelation, running around with just you cannot, there's this big city that's 1,200 miles by 1,200 miles, whether it's literal or not, the fact of the matter is God knows how to make a vibrant city. So it's going to be happening, there's going to be lions and lambs playing, it's just going to be a great place. So with that in mind, based upon that thought, God's going to give you all that, you're going to be joint heir with Jesus. Then the very next thing says, the next verse says, therefore sell your possessions and give to the needy. Provide yourself with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Motivated by the hope to come, motivated by what Jesus has promised, motivated by a future that is filled with unimaginable intense pleasure, the pleasure of God, sacrifice now. So at the heart of mercy, I think, is this teaching, the sacrifice, that we should figure out what does it look like to live in a downward mobile lifestyle so that we can free up more of our resources to help the poor. As we get toward the end of our time, I'm going to paint for you some pictures about how I see God's people in our particular community living that out. I mentioned already the dentist, he's actually down in Dominican right now. His goal is to retire in a couple of years and do full-time ministry for the poor. He's got a trip organized to Kenya, Africa this summer to work in some of the ghettos providing free dental care. He recruits saved and unsaved, believing and unbelieving medical people to go with him. And that's his life passion. I just admire a man like that who would take his wealth and his success, and he's got a very successful practice, and leverage it in such a way, in a downward mobile way, actually. And he has everything you and I would like, but he doesn't live like a very successful dentist would. He lives as a missional man would. All right. We talked about, laid the framework from what I see is in Genesis chapter 3, is God modeling mercy. We looked at what Jesus said about mercy. Because you have so much coming, because you have so much in store, because I am going to, my pleasure is going to be your pleasure in the eternal kingdom. Therefore, sacrifice, give up, live in such a way you can meet the needs of the poor. Now we got the issue of what do we do in church? And for those of us who started churches, it's easy to become sort of single-minded about what you do. And forgetting, I don't have time for the poor, and I don't have time for this, and I don't have time for that. Look with me at Galatians 2, verses 9 and 10. Here we find Paul being approved by the church planting network, the Acts 29, actually it's not quite, but you got him being approved by Cephas and John and one other guy in there. Galatians chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. Why doesn't this look right in my book? Yeah. And when James and Cephas and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given to me, they gave the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and me, that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. Okay, you've made it through. If any of you are familiar with Acts 29, this would be the sort of church planning assessment to boot camp, and they've been approved. And they said, okay, your target audience is the Gentiles. We'll take care of the Jews, which seemed to be an imbalanced proportion, but anyway, Paul felt like he was up to the job. But one of the things that they had learned from their experience that they wanted to get the last sort of like nugget of truth out the door from, who was it again? Yeah, James and Cephas and John, the pillars of the church up to that point, to Paul, who had become for us God's inspired model for impacting a culture with the gospel. What were their parting thoughts out the door? Forget the poor. There seems to be a concern that in their experience is that when you get so wrapped up in the kingdom and the gospel and people that it's easy to say, I don't have time for the poor, I can't give time to the poor. And we're going to see in a moment, I don't think it's my job to promote, or I'm sorry, to organize and structure specific ministry to the poor, But as they said here in verse 10, only they asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I was eager to do. It's ironic that after passing the church planning assessment and all that, their one parting counsel is don't forget the poor. It's not sexy. It's not going to help the bottom line. It's not going to raise money. I asked Matt, who spoke here earlier, I said, Matt, how much do you get paid to do this? He says, no, I have two full-time jobs. I'm sort of a full-time volunteer pastor. That's what I do. Money for the poor is just not easy to come by. And strategically, when you start a church, you're not going, okay, we need a pastor of extension ministries. We can't afford it. It's not, doesn't generate, you know, all the great volunteers we need to do church. There seems to be a bias towards advancing the kingdom to forget the poor. And so just a little picture here, church planning, don't forget the poor. Now, let's go back to Acts chapter 6. Acts chapter 6, and I hope you don't mind that all I'm doing here is a little Bible study on the issue of mercy. And we're going to end up here with, I'm going to tell you our story and some practical outworks and workings of that in the last 6 years. Acts chapter 6, if you know the story. Now in these days when the disciples were increasing in number, and you got to kind of give these guys a break. I mean, the church at this point, it might have been up to 8,000-9,000 people. I mean, it's grown rapidly. Their numbers are increasing. A complaint by the Hellenists arose against the Hebrews because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution. And the 12 summoned the full number of the disciples and said, "It is not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. Therefore, brothers, pick out from among you seven men of good repute, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we will appoint to this duty, but we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." And what they said pleased the whole gathering, and they chose Stephen and got the list of the seven guys. I personally think these are the first deacons. They were men assigned to a task, given over to a task, and the task was significant and successful. Here's how I look at it, and I think this is what they're saying. And I just came out of a boot camp. For those of you familiar with Acts 29, we run these boot camps 5 or 6 times a year. And those of us who have planted churches, sometimes they ask us to come in to assess guys who are in the application process. And I wasn't intending to go down to Raleigh this past week, but there were so many guys applying to come to the Northeast, which is sort of so cool, just exciting. So I went down there, and of course I'm sitting through and listening to some great guys teach, and now they've got 2 tracks, one for the main group, and then for those who've been through boot camp a number of times, another track. And there's a guy talking. His name is Elliot Grudem, son of Wayne Grudem. He's planted a Presbyterian church or replanted a Presbyterian church in Raleigh, and he's teaching, and he's speaking from Romans 12, 1 and 2, and it hits me really hard again. He says, if we're called to lead pastor a church, our priorities are study the word, prayer, and developing maturity or leadership in the church. Those are your priorities. You can't get distracted from that. And I got thinking about that. I've been doing this 22 years, 3 different settings. I pastored a 200-year-old Baptist church for 10 years and transitioned it, trying to make it more missional. That was pretty cool. Then I was on staff at a mega church down outside of Baltimore over the line in Pennsylvania, and that was kind of cool. And then planted a church 6 years ago, and that's been cool. It's been hot, but it's been cool. But this is so true. These are the 3 things that if you're called to being in the lead pastor role, study God's word, prayer, and leadership development. That's all you really have time to do. Okay, what about this deal? Well, this Acts 6 says the culture of mercy, the culture of caring for the poor can't be overlooked. And we find in this very passage the apostles setting the model, saying you got to take care of it, find reliable people whom you can trust with this matter. So that for me provides the biblical framework for saying, okay, how do we then do practical mercy ministry in a way that cares for the poor? And what I want to shift to now is just talking through some practical stories, how we do it. Because we're by no means, let me explain where I'm situated. Concord, New Hampshire. Concord, New Hampshire is not the hub of much. Okay, it's New Hampshire's a great place to live, high quality of life, ninth in the nation when it comes to income per capita. When it comes to giving per capita, the last 5 or 6 years running, we're 50th out of 50 states. We're the last as far as giving, because New Hampshire people, our motto is on our license plate, live free or die. You can't pay it for yourself, you're going to starve, sucker. That's pretty much how it's interpreted. It's just a stingy place, wealthy place. Concord is a tiny city, 45,000 people, pretty highly educated. I got Gene Robinson, the gay bishop of the Episcopal Church, a mile away from me. Dan Brown wrote the Da Vinci Code 35 miles to my east. And then south, we got Harvard. North, I got Dartmouth. We're the hub of secular reason. And in the midst of that, we've got poverty. So when I started church, and ironically, when we started the church, I recruited my best friend who was pastoring a little mountain church 50 miles north. And I recruited him to say, would you come and help us do discipleship? We were meeting on Sunday night so he could pastor his little American Baptist church of about 30 people on Sunday morning, drive 50 miles south at night, and he would join us. And he's a Gordon Conwell grad, great guy, deep thinker. And his number one spiritual gift is mercy. So for about 2 years, he worked with us. And in Concord, we identified two marginalized communities. Rick McKinley, some of you may know his name. He's written a book called God in the Margins or Church in the Margins or something. But he talks about this whole idea of who's in the margins of your society. And in Concord, we've got two groups primarily. One are the parolees. We've got a big state penitentiary right in Concord. And they get dumped out on the street, no job, no house, and they're expected to make it. So we identified them and said, we got parolees running around. The other group is New Hampshire, especially in Concord, is 98-99% Caucasian. But the New Hampshire government has been bringing refugees in and settling them in Concord. We got, at this point, two primary groups. Africans from Central Africa, which come from a number of different ethnic groups. And then we have got people from Nepal who have been living in refugee camps for about 10, 15 years, about 100 of them. So we identify them. My job, pastor, they say, we got these two groups. Didn't do anything for them, but there they are. I didn't have time. I was doing what I'm supposed to do, but we identified those. Just as a little side note, my friend up north, he's pastoring this 200-year-old little Baptist church. And he leads his little church through this thought process saying, up in the mountains of New Hampshire where his church is, there's a lot of blue-collar, or I'm sorry, shouldn't call them blue-collar, but it's seasonal workers who work up there in the, our number one industry in New Hampshire is tourism, skiing in the winter, camping and swimming during the summer, and we set up toll booths to charge you coming in and out and put liquor stores on our highways to sell you booze and tell you not to drink while you drive. That's New Hampshire. Brilliant. Up in the mountains, though, there's a lot of second, third generation poverty, people who can barely scrape by getting by working at the ski slopes and at the campgrounds and all this stuff, and a lot of substance abuse. And my friend suggested to his congregation, because they get calls from needy people looking for money for motel, I said, why don't we take our little white building here and standing here for 200 years, why don't we make some of it into transitional housing, put a shower in it, figure out all the regulations we need to do, and see if we can house some of these folks. Not to be a homeless shelter in the official sense, but a transitional housing place with rules. And my friend was there for 10 years, got this thing going. Again, this is a church of 30 people. And this transitional housing ministry up there in the mountain continues. After he... he's now a full-time chaplain with the National Guard, but long story. But he's become a paradigm shift for mountain churches who look at their building as something to heat all winter and use one day a week. And suddenly you go, wait a minute, we can house needy people here. Now, that drove a lot of people away from his church. They didn't like it. I tell you that story as a little side note, a little commercial, a little infomercial for if you get into a situation where you got an old church building, There's a potential use of it. Here's some of the practical things I've thought through. In my role in being a lead pastor in a church and wanting us to be a place of mercy. First thing, it becomes a message, a priority in our message, that if what Jesus asks us in Micah chapter 6, 8, what does he require? What does he want? He wants us to do justice. He wants us to love kindness and mercy. He wants us to walk with humility, walk with a sense of brokenness and a sense of our own need. If that is if I keep that as a part of our message, and you can lace that. You don't have to find it. You don't have to go looking for it. Jesus said, "The greatest in this room is the one who serves the most." I have a lot of white collar folks. We got the guys who are pierced and tattooed, and I got two Harvard lawyers, 160, 145, in our car. We got beautiful slice of our civilization. We really are a heterogeneous church. We have everything in our town, in our church. But it's easy for people who have clean houses and clean lives and to think that they're somehow better than the guys who don't. And this has become a strong message in our congregation. The greatest person in our church is the one who serves like Jesus the most, who exercises compassion and mercy and all this. And whether it's watching children whose parents are overseas at the National Guard, and I'll list through some of the things God has birthed in our church. Here's what else I'm convinced of. Ministry in our church is not what I strategize. I'm not the most strategic pencil in the drawer. I don't know if you have strategic pencils, but I do believe this. If I am fostering maturity, if I'm preaching God's word, challenging people to mature, if I'm praying for them, God, through his Spirit, will organically grow things he wants to happen. And I'll talk about in a moment a mobilizing strategy, because in our church we have we've broken things down into some teams, and that's where that after organic development, I'm convinced when Jesus sent his disciples out two by two, I think there was an idea birthed with him. If someone comes to you and says, "I have a good idea," in fact, I'll talk about one. One a woman came to us and she said, "I have this good idea. I want to start an orphans ministry." I didn't know what an orphans ministry was. What do you have? What do you mean? What are you talking about? She slides me this DVD that makes you cry, and because all these orphans all over the world. Now, she's a reputable young woman. She's noble. My first challenge to her says, "Well, if this is of God," and she's in tears, and she says, "This is not something I ever wanted to do, but God just hit me with this, and I feel it. I got to do it. I can't live. You know, I can't." I said, "Okay, if this is of God, this is what I typically do. Who else will you find to recruit to join you to do this? You need at least another person." Here's my conviction. Any ministry carried by one person is in jeopardy of sinking if one person gets sick, gets upset, gets relocated, gets something else. Besides that, any ministry of substance, you're pushing against the kingdom of darkness. Good theology says, I'm not just making a missional imprint, but I am moving into where the kingdom of darkness was. That sets you up for all sorts of dangers, attacks, and discouragement. So, two by two, I think there's a strategy to that. What that is sort of translated in our church is, if it's of a substance, it needs to be team ministry. There needs to be reputable people, some reputable person leading it, a reputable person. And in our church, a person leading a ministry like that needs to meet the qualification of deacon or deaconess in the Bible. So they have to meet the Titus or Timothy, 1 Timothy 3 qualifications. They need to be able to recruit at least one other person to work with them. If they do that, then they have our blessing. They don't have any money yet, but they have our blessing. We have four of those things going on. We have what's called our global missions team, and they strategize about short-term mission trips and who to support. That's a church planner around the globe. We have a young couple in our that we're connected with that are planning to go to Cambodia to plant tribes, churches with new tribe missions. So their job is to strategize. And we give them a chunk of money. We just do. We raise some money. We do some faith promise things. And I think they get about $35,000 to play with around the world. So that's the global missions team. Then we have what we call benevolence. Benevolence is a team of people, and they're sort of our black ops. Nobody knows who they are. Well, that's not true. But they work this sort of secret clandestine. They give away money. They've got about, I don't know, $5,000 or $6,000 to give away every year. And their job is to be around, be aware of people in the congregation, outside of the congregation, just to give money away to, whether it's to pay, fill up an oil tank, single mom with broken down car, that sort of stuff. So benevolence. So we got global missions, we got benevolence. Again, it's team oriented, run by, led by a person who meets the qualification of deacon, deaconess, and they're off and running. Then we have what's called community ministries, which is our local ministry focus, and our job, their job, their stated job is to mobilize our congregation to serve our community by creating opportunities and building partnerships with other ministries. So they, their job is to mobilize our body to with opportunities and joining in partnership with other ministries. They've got a list that they've succeeded at. Like I mentioned, the National Guard doesn't cost a dime. But through our connection with the National Guard, these kids whose moms or dads are in Afghanistan or Iraq, they need a dad or mom image, at least in that room once a month. It becomes really easy. Who's going to volunteer to serve there? And we do the opposite of what they do at ICTERRA. We really promote our small group and say, hey, would your small group serve once a year at the National Guard? It's just a small little no-brainer. We have that. I mentioned the African refugee community. There's actually an African refugee church that we've adopted in Concord. It's the only refugee church in Concord at all. And through our community ministries and our global missions, they sort of work together on this one. How can we best serve this church? And they're doing all sorts of creative stuff. They're helping them learn. The two things they need is learning English, always a need, and daytime transportation. Concord, you know, live free or die. You can imagine our bus system. anyway, providing transportation for them. So one of the things that they're doing is calling through our church directory and say, hey, would you be willing to be available for transportation? And finding people who either stay-at-home moms or, you know, retirees. Again, our church is, we have somethings to almost 200-year-old somethings. Well, we don't have many of those left, but we still do. Also through this community ministries and teaming with the Globe Missions thing, we've hooked up with Lutheran services, social services, and we have about probably a half dozen people trained through their training to adopt a family who moves to town. And the newest thing that's happened is they dropped 100 Nepalese people, I think that's how you pronounce it, into Concord. And they've got to find sponsoring people for all these new refugees. Come to find out of those 100, there are about 6 of them who are believers. And they travel 70 miles south every Sunday to go to a Nepalese church in Boston. They're tired of that. So through all these conversations, they're willing to be there and show mercy and all this stuff. These conversations have happened. How can we help the Nepalese believers reach their little community there in Concord? I mentioned the prison ministry. We became a... Because we network with local ministries, the local chaplain, not the official chaplain at the state prison, but the sort of the evangelical chaplain who himself used to be a convict 22 years ago. We've networked with him. We actually support him financially. And what we've done with him is he's got us, we've become the safe harbor for convicts when they come out, and especially the guys who come to Christ. We've got 4 members of our church who are all ex-cons. 3 of them, this sounds scary, were sex offenders. Now, dealing with that is a whole new realm. You saw my daughter up there, right, earlier? I don't want pagan sex offenders hanging around my daughter unless we've got a plan. Now, these guys are converted. They've gone through the process. You can tell an honest, well, anyway, one guy has to come with a chaperone by parole officer's edict. But I got to tell you, by loving these guys and doing it in a safe way, and the congregation knows we got this sort of process of keeping it safe, and we don't put them on the money team either. You know, they don't count money. I could tell you some stories, but one guy originally had gone in for rape, and then he came back out, and then he went back in as an extortionist, and he did like 17 years, and then had a radical conversion to Jesus, and he's not one of the guys you put on your finance team. You just say, you know, for the rest of your life, you're not going to work with kids, and you're not going to work with money. So he helps run our multimedia stuff. Anyway, it's a cool story. Where am I going with that? Oh, generating this culture by making a message priority. We've generated a culture where everybody's asking the question about how can I serve the poor, the needy. Our music guy, who has he's got this band together on the side, he arranged with the guy, the prison chaplain, said, "Hey, how about if we get into the prison and do a service there once every quarter?" Now, you got to understand, for musicians to haul all their stuff through all the security into the chapel. And by the way, they have actually the chapel room in this prison is actually pretty astonishing. It's great. But they had to go through, it took them 8 months to get approved. And then every time we go in, you know, you go in and you have to, they bring in, they've got carts of all this equipment. They got to open it all up. And the guards, you know, what am I looking for? I don't know. And but what has happened to that is this, once a quarter we go in. I think we've done it now for a year. Maybe we started in August. So I think we've done it three times. Coming up on our fourth time, I think. I forget. But suddenly the prisoners in the state penitentiary, the chapel has filled to capacity, standing room only, which they can't allow. They have to find seats. We had over 120 prisoners packed in this chapel last time because the musicians had a passion for caring for prisoners. Sharing all that to say, I don't do much with any of this other than keep on message that Jesus is a God of mercy. We find that in Genesis with Adam and Eve. We find it with Jesus in Luke chapter 12. We find it with Paul in Galatians 2, where he's being sent out as, or Galatians, 2, where he's being sent out as a church planter. Remember the poor. My job is to keep the church environment one where we're saying, how can we be the hands and feet of Jesus? One sort of last story, and then we can kind of open it up for dialogue and or quit early and go get a coffee. This woman who had this burden for orphans, she said, yeah, God bless you, Heidi. She recruited a reputable person. She worked with our local ministries, which has a slice of budget, and she came up last year with a couple girls from one girl who is 15 years old and has been in state custody in group homes or foster homes since she was three. One messed up little girl. Her and another girl, actually three girls, we paid their way to the premier Christian camp in New Hampshire, never been to. And this one girl has come to Jesus. And the transformation of life is great, although it's kind of messy because she's been all this time in this whacked out world. But it's beautiful to watch. So Heidi had her first success the first summer. She asked for money for scholarship for the girl. So now she's got this bigger vision. She says she wants to bring in six kids to this organization from Columbia, ages 7 to 14, who are far from being, well, people who do international adoption are always going for the babies. That's who they go for. So by the time a kid gets to 7 to 14, they're not really ideal for adoption. There's an agency, not even the Christian agency, which brings these kids in for a summer hosting program with the hopes of finding them forever families, adoptive families. And so Heidi gets this vision. She's going to help raise the money. It's like $4,000 a kid. So that's what, 24, is that 24,000? I guess. Six kids, yeah, four, something like that. No, I don't do math. I'm not on the finance team either. She's got a vision for this. Well, she bands up with our community ministries teams and says, well, how can we raise some funds for this and get community awareness? So we did this last year and it succeeded. One of the parents of teenagers, we got a ton of teenagers in the church, says, can we do a dance that's healthy? You know, that isn't, you know, bump and grind in the high school crap. So they did this sock hop that was supposed to be a 50s thing, and it had a 50s thing, but it also had some of the most modern stuff going on too, but it was a family thing. It raised some money for some girls' home we supported down in a local city, a neighboring city, a girls' home. It's a Christian home for single moms who have kids, and the single moms have addiction problems. So we raised money for them, like $2,000 last year through the sock hop. It was kind of a silly thing. I went, and it was a lot of fun. Take my kids. You can't go to, other than like weddings, you can't find a good place to take your teenage kids dancing. And I got five teenage kids. So she has co-opted the sock hop this year. She's got a number of community organizations. Anybody will support orphans. She's got like six or eight churches. Now, most of them don't know the dance thing's going on, and we live in a very conservative evangelical community. It's 3% of the population is very tiny, but they're conservative. So when they find out about the dance, I don't know what they're going to do. But anyway, she has been at this thing with her little team with humility, with prayer, and it's so cool because I think she's got a network of like 20, 25 people who are helping to bring these six orphans from Columbia to Concord with the intention of seeing them adopted. All of that by I think these things. By my job is to keep it a priority on message by expecting Jesus to tap people on the shoulder like with Heidi. And Heidi was just and by the way, Heidi's background is working with the DCYF. She is actually not a home inspector, but that's what she does. She inspects homes for people who are going to be foster parents. So she's wired for this. God knew who to pick. She's found a teammate. They've built this little organization, and God's hand is on it because I think God is a God that blesses mercy. The 2x2 leadership was essential, and then the whole mobilizing strategy was for us as a church, how do we build these teams? So we got global, we got benevolence, we got local, and now we got orphans. How do we build these teams in such a way that they have a measure of accountability, they're being led by someone who meets the deaconess qualification, they've got a team. Now, all four of those ministries have their own budget. I think Orphans Ministry is tiny because it's new. Global has like 35,000. They got a pretty big budget. But, you know, giving them resources, promoting them, and letting them go about it. At the end of the day, I stand back and go, it's so good to be in a body that is filled with merciful people, people who are meeting the Micah deal. You know, what does it mean to approach God? Do justice. Don't know what that means. We'll find out at the next session. Mercy. I get that one. Mercy means caring for the poor in any way God would stir up the body to do that and to walk humbly with God. That's how we sort of do it. I promote it. I cheerlead it. I show up to the things I want. I don't do this. Like yesterday, I was at the National Guard bouncing kids on my lap. There's a little kid there. I focused on a little guy by the name of Mikey, who's 3 years old, who never leaves his mom's side, and he stayed with us. And I played with him for 2 hours. Now, I don't do this a lot, but it was our small group that was doing this. So I showed up, did it. And little Mikey's been on my mind because his dad's in Afghanistan or Iraq, and he's fatherless right now. And we just played the most squirrely games in the world. And I actually felt a little like God. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't trying to rule a kingdom here. But in the sense of the pleasure God has in bringing joy to a little guy's life. And I think if we can create environments like that, God will organically grow things. You've got to have the structure. You've got to have people. You've got to have the teams. I think you got to have the budgets. You got to do all that stuff. My job is to step back, to preach the word, to pray, and to work on the leadership. And if I'm doing those three things, I think mercy will then become a natural byproduct of the church. From my perspective, now you may be different on this. My perspective is I'm not picking the ministries and saying, here's what we should do. You may be led to do that. I do need to identify the marginalized communities. It was easy for us to identify the refugees and the prisoners. I just identified them, kept preaching. God raised up the right people. It's happening. So keep before the people. What are the needs that you see in the community? Concord's a whole lot different than Troy, and what these guys got going on here is just blows my mind away. It's kind of like I'm driving a Mazda Miata, and these guys are flying a space shuttle when it comes to what I see the difference between thinking and strategy. But I do think at the heart of mercy becomes this creating the culture of people who are merciful. All right, that's about it. That's what I've got. I don't have a lot more to say. Any questions? Rob. Hey. Yes, they are French-speaking. hardest people to figure out, because I am terrible cross-cultural. I've gone to Cambodia and Indonesia and Guatemala and Dominican and every place. I get really sick, and I still don't understand them. And they ask me to preach. I don't get it. So they asked me to preach at the African church, and I'm, you know, through an interpreter. And let me tell you this coolest story, okay? Can I take a little? Yes, they're French. You asked if they're French speaking. My dad's my hero. He's pastored in New Hampshire 25 years. I was born when he was 42 years old. I don't recommend it. I mean, I don't recommend. I had my kids when they were young. I like it better that way. Anyway, dad is 87 in a nursing home. He's got dementia. You know, he loves Jesus. In fact, he sees himself on mission. Even though he wants to be at home with mom, he sees himself on mission. We get him into the nursing home the first time back in August. And the first day we're there, this is traumatizing. This is our hero. This is the patriarch of our family, the man who has modeled Jesus for me. I love Jesus because of my dad. So here I, you know, with my sisters, putting my dad in a nursing home, leaving for the first night, and I'm getting onto the elevator, and who walks by is one of these African brothers from the church, Rest for the Nation's church that we work with. And I look at him, I go, I can't remember his name because I've got a little tad of dementia too. And I go, he thought I was speaking some language. And he turned around, and he goes, Pastor David. His name is Sam. Sam is their number one interpreter. He speaks four languages. It's amazing. But he was my dad's caregiver. And I would never have known that. That would have never happened if the whole thing with the Africans hadn't transpired. And I kind of look at God saying, see, Dave, when you take care of the needy among you, there's a payback somewhere else, and they're going to be taking care of your dad. I mean, I can't tell. I get messed up in my mind, teary-eyed, when I think about that story, because Sam, this guy, is one of the elders in this Rest for the Nation's African church, and he's just the most joyful believer in the world. And so he'd go in at night and have prayer with dad and read dad's got dementia, so he thinks he's in a church-run home, and he's not. He thinks he's in a church all the time. I mean, this is where dad is. And I got to tell you, it's one of those small little paybacks for doing mercy ministry. Comes around, and there's Sam taking care of my dad. So, a cool story. Thanks for asking a little question. Yeah, they speak French. We got to help them out, though, because there's these other Africans. They don't talk with them. Oh, actually, somebody's a Hutu, you know, the whole Rwanda thing. A bunch of them come through all that, and there's still some bias going on in the Christian community. And then we got the Muslim Somalians in town. And anyway, we got work to do, but yeah. Any other? How's it working for you guys? What are you guys doing for mercy ministry? What do you see happening that seems to have some legs to it? Yeah, 2x2 leadership. I think Jesus had a good idea there. I don't think it was like an accident. If someone comes to you and has one idea, a great idea, my first question is, okay, who can you recruit to join you? And if they're good, they'll get, you know, the only downside is they come back with another, you know, if they're both wacky, then you got to deal with that. But that hasn't happened yet. If it's someone who is truly credible, they can get someone who say, yes, I will sign on to that. And it's amazing. Becomes a strong ministry. And then they start their own little conversations. They're not calling you saying, how should I do this? They're talking to each other. It's like Jesus had this plan. Anyway, I think it's, yeah, it helps. I just say our policy is to follow what Jesus did. You need to find somebody else to join you in this. See, when you quote Jesus, it like covers it really good. If you got a verse, you know. So that's what I do, the 2x2 thing. So we just make it church practice. And where we still fail at doing that sometimes, where there's, we got some nightmare stories. Like we thought we had 2x2 for something, and they can't talk to each other, and so it's kind of a mess. It's typical. I divide my life a little bit to my personal responsibility. Like all my kids but my daughter have been to Dominican Republic. I'm going to make sure my kids get exposed to the poverty of the world and volunteer in that setting. My daughter, we just haven't got her down there yet. Our small group, the small group I lead, now, ideally, if the church were ever to be, like I was on staff at a big church, you know, the big church, well, there's a lot of different ways to look at doing small groups, especially as a church leader. But I've got these young adults in our small group, and so I said, you know what? They've been asking for small groups to do this National Guard thing. You guys want to do it? Now, I was hoping I didn't have to go, but I knew as the group leader, I'd need to be willing to go. And I got there, and I had a class to teach last night. I needed more prep time. I'd just gotten back from boot camp. I got in at 2 in the morning on Saturday because my twin boys turned 18. I was just stressed out. I didn't want to go take care of little kids, and Jesus kind of reminded me that this is true religion, to visit the widows and the orphans in their infirmities. And this little kid, Mikey's dad, has been away for 6 months, probably at least another 6 months. I could be his dad image. And I got there, and God just broke my heart. I repented. I said, this is the best church I've had all day, playing with Mikey. And so I model it in my personal life. I model it in ministry. The prison thing, I'll give my gifts. My gifts, I can preach. Well, you may not think so, but I pretend I can preach. I can preach. I can serve. That's about it. So like the prison thing, when the band goes in, I'll preach if they want. And it's been awesome. I mean, it's just been awesome. And then some of the guys cycle out of the prison, and they know me. And some of them call me Pastor Dave. And it's kind of like, we got this thing going. And I don't give my address. Never give me your last name. Found that out. Anyway, so I try to give my gifts. I try to model it personally at a personal level. But I also have to say, like the African guy, he will be in my office every week if I let him. So we had to say, no, you're working with, and you have to say it about three times because they don't understand it necessarily. No, you're working with, and we give him away to, it's not that I don't care about him, but, and I can, like I can raise money. I don't know what, I got this gift, I can ask people for money, and they give money. So like this African guy, we got this group going to Nairobi, Kenya. This African pastor in our town, his mom's over there suffering cancer. I think I'll get his ticket paid for it. He's going to go. In fact, if you guys want to donate to him, see me afterwards. Right, you can write out a check to River of Grace Church, and we'll make sure it goes to Manasseh. But so I can do that. I can fundraise for people or ministries or kickstart things, or be the front guy. Like for the dance, I got to tell you, I had some people in our church because we got this blended church. We got the tattooed. I got the Harley Davidson, number one salesman in town, who's got his tattoos up. He's got a nice sleeve. The big word right there says resist. Tries to remind him. He's just a. I got him, and I got blue-haired ladies. Figure that out. And so, you know, you throw a dance, and you got some people that are kind of like all over the place. You just got to be the front guy. Say, no, this is what Jesus would do. And you know how to play the players, and you get it going. So sometimes I feel like I'm a front guy to help get the ball moving. But then I step back. If it can't go without me, it's not going to go, because I got to pray, preach, and develop leaders. If I do that, I'll stay sane.